Exploring the Word is brought to you by Reclaiming America for Christ and the Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond, Oklahoma. This is Pastor Paul Blair. Thank you for joining us for today's edition of Exploring the Word. Today we're going to be continuing a message that we began last time, dealing with God's blessings on Israel and also some of the general blessings that we were able to appropriate in our country when we actually lived in obedience. I hope that you enjoy the conclusion of this message that we began last time entitled, The God-Blessed Land.
We welcome you to the radio ministry of Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond. We invite you to join with us for today's Exploring the Word. Here's Pastor Paul Blair.
America had been birthed on Christian liberty, and it was the pastors that taught the biblical principles upon which American government was established. The fundamental principle that all men were created equal comes from the Bible. The concept of natural law comes from the Bible. The inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness come from the Bible. The monogamous family unit comes from the Bible. Our laws of morality come from the Bible. The ownership and rights of private property comes from the Bible. The right to a fair trial comes from the Bible. No conviction without two or three witnesses comes from the Bible. Having a punishment that fits the crime comes from the Bible. The republican form of government comes from the Bible. A written constitution limiting the power of the government and guaranteeing the rights of men come from the Bible. Our three branches of government are patterned after the three positional offices of Christ, as found in Isaiah 33:22. The Lord is our king, the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver. He will save us. Folks, the signers of our Declaration of Independence claimed that it was the laws of nature and nature's God, the Bible, that gave them the right of independence from England. It was God that ordained government, and its purpose was clearly defined. And when a government becomes perverted, then man has a right to fix it. Blackstone, Sir William Blackstone, said this. By the way, this man wrote commentaries. He was the cornerstone of American law in the middle of the 18th century. If you studied law, you studied Blackstone. And he defined what natural law was. He said, man, considered as a creature, must necessarily be subject to the laws of his creator, for he is entirely a dependent being. A state of dependence will inevitably oblige the inferior to take the will of him on whom he depends on as the rule of his conduct. And consequently, as man depends absolutely on his maker for everything, it is necessary that he should in all points conform to his maker's will. This will of his maker is called the law of nature. And this law of nature, dictated by God himself, is of course superior of obligation to any other. It is binding over all the globe, in all countries, and at all times. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this. The doctrines thus delivered we call the revealed or divine law, and they are to be found only in the Holy Scriptures. To instance, talking about the importance and supremacy of God over man. To instance, in the case of murder, this is expressly forbidden by the divine. If any human law should allow or enjoin us to commit abortion, for example, then we are bound to transgress that human law. But with regard to matters that are not commanded or forbidden by those superior laws, such, for example, exporting of wool into foreign countries, here the legislature has scope and opportunity to interpose. The foundation of America law said this: if God has spoken, then it's settled. What has God said about marriage? One man, one woman. Guess what? It's settled. We don't have the right to break what God has said. What about killing of unborn babies? It's settled. God forbids murder. Says to cherish that which is within the womb. But what if man crafts a law that says man cannot in America make a law that contradicts what God has said? James Wilson, a signer of the Constitution and one of our first members of the United States Supreme Court, said this: all laws, however, may be arranged in two different classes, divine and human, but it should always be remembered that this law, natural law or revealed, in other words, the Bible, made for the men or for nations, flows from the same divine source. It is the law of God. Human law must rest its authority ultimately upon the authority of that law which is divine. Alexander Hamilton, an assistant to George Washington during the American Revolution, and also a signer of the Constitution, said this: the law dictated by God himself is, of course, superior in obligation to any other. It is binding over all the globe and in all countries at all times. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this. Ladies and gentlemen, any human government could not contradict God's law, according to our founders. It must be established by written word or constitution, and only with the consent of those that were governed by it. Well, why is that? Because that's how God said it should be done. When God proposed to Israel in Exodus chapter 19, he said, I've called you to be a nation, a kingdom of priests. And Moses went down to the people, and the people agreed and said, all the things that you have said, we will do. They submitted to this proposal that God had given to them. When Jethro told Moses that he needed help, they were commanded to choose out from among the people capable men that feared God and hated covetousness. Notice the government in the Bible is of the people, by the people, and for the people. Now look what American pastors had to say about this very subject with the consent of the governed. Pastor John Davenport in 1663, pastor of the First Church of Boston, in a sermon entitled A Discourse About Civil Government, he said, people are born and ought naturally to be free. Men being born into a family society, it is necessary that they be joined in a civil society, enter into a compact or corporate body, and they measure out civil power. So hedged about, their power cannot be used against the rights and liberties of the people, removable by the people if the conditions set by the people be violated. It's exactly what I said a while ago. If we lived off by ourselves, the only law we'd be under was God's law. But when we move together in a community, we have to have some civil law. But that civil authority is limited by the power that we, the people, have entrusted to them. And if they step outside that power, we have the responsibility to fix it. Notice the names of these. Pastor Thomas Hooker, who happened to be the founder of Connecticut. Do you notice the connection between religious liberty and civil liberty? He said this. In a letter to John Winthrop, the foundation of authority is laid firstly in the free consent of the people. Reverend Roger Williams, the founder of Rhode Island, said the sovereign, original, and foundation of civil power lies in the people, and it is evident that such governments as are by them erected and established have no more power, nor for no longer time, that the civil power or people consenting and agreeing shall be trust with them. Folks, let's review. We have a standard of truth in America, a foundation upon which everything rests. It's called natural law or God's law. No law can contradict God's law, and no one has a right to do wrong. Man, in order to protect his life, liberty, and property, and in order to live in a civil society, enters into a covenant entrusting certain limited powers to the proper authority. Man may not give away something that he does not possess. For example, I cannot say I give to the government 50% of Bob Daney's income because I don't have the right to 50% of Bob Daney's income. Number five, the government derives its power by the consent of the governed and is limited to the powers entrusted to it and cannot break the law nor overstep the powers entrusted to it. And when that doesn't happen, man has a right to fix it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this brings us to where we're at with the 4th of July. Our founders stated clearly their grievances in the Declaration. They said, when a long train of abuses and usurpations have taken place, pursuing invariably the same object, attempting to reduce them under the control of absolute despotism, it is the people's right, it is their duty to throw off such despotic, tyrannical government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. And then they proceeded with 27 grievances listed. Every one of those grievances came from sermons that had been preached by preachers of the Black Robe Regiment. Look at what Baldwin said in her book, The New England Clergy and the American Revolution. Historians have sometimes believed that those theories, revolutionary thought, were exotic and were foisted upon the people by a few book-learned political leaders when the revolutionary ferment began. But a study such as this of the teachings of the ministers proves rather that a New Englander could not have helped thinking in terms of natural and fundamental law and constitutional right. government consent and the illegality of an unconstitutional act were to him as unquestioned as the divine law which gave them sanction. There is not a right asserted in the Declaration of Independence which had not been clearly discussed by the New England clergy prior to 1763. I am one that is born out of due time. It was preachers that had searched the scriptures for God's principles of government and taught those principles of freedom to America. John Adams and Sam Adams and John Hancock and James Otis and James Madison and Benjamin Franklin are just a sampling of the men that were trained by Reverend Samuel Cooper of Brattle Square Church in Boston, Reverend Charles Chauncey of First Church in Boston, Reverend Jonathan Mayhew of West Church in Boston, Reverend John Witherspoon, the president of Princeton, and the Reverend Jonas Clark of Lexington. You all, I know, are familiar with the midnight ride of Paul Revere as the British crossed by sea and had 700 troops heading north to Lexington and Concord to arrest two rebels and to capture a reported store of rebel arms. They were looking to arrest and hang Sam Adams and John Hancock. You know, they knew exactly where they would find them. They were staying at the home of the pastor of the church in Lexington, Pastor Jonas Clark. He happened to be a brother-in-law of Hancock, and he was considered to be an expert on politics. This was said by the historian Joel Headley about Pastor Clark. He said this. Now notice the balance. You know, some people are so heavenly minded, they're of no earthly good. Joel Headley said this. Pastor Clark presented the truths of the gospel with a fervor and power that always commanded the deepest attention of his hearers. His voice was powerful and agreeable, and when excited by his subject, which was often the case, it extended far beyond the bounds of the meeting house and could be heard distinctly by those who were anywhere in the immediate neighborhood. Earnestly, in addition, he discussed from the pulpit the great questions at issue, and that powerful voice thundered forth the principles of personal, civil, and religious liberty and the right of resistance in tones as earnest and effective as it had the doctrine of salvation of the cross. Long before it was certain that the quarrel must come to blows, he had so thoroughly indoctrinated his people with these great truths that no better spot on the continent could have been found for the British first to try the terror of their arms and make the experiment to subjugate the colonists by force. As Revere left, Adams and Hancock asked Pastor Clark if the people, his townsmen, would stand and fight. And Pastor Clark said, "I have trained them for this very hour. They will fight, and if need be, die, too, under the shadow of the house of God." In the wee hours that morning at sunrise, as the church bells rang, Pastor Clark was standing out there with his men. And it was that local church that faced off and fired the first shots of America's independence. Was that unusual? No, ladies and gentlemen, that's who the Minutemen were. Listen to this narrative from Baldwin's study on the subject. These fighting parsons had their muskets ready. In September of 1774, an alarm spread through the country that a clash had come in Boston, and handbills were read in Connecticut churches on the Sabbath morning. At once, the clergy responded. Reverend Jonathan Todd of East Guilford marched with 83 of his parishioners, the Reverend Mr. May of Haddam and the Reverend Mr. Boardman of Chatham with 100 each. All that winter, many were helping their people to be ready for any emergency. Reverend John Adams of Durham, New Hampshire, in December of 1774, went with others to take supplies from the fort at Newcastle. In other words, they attacked the fort, and it is said he stored the gunpowder underneath his pulpit. The Reverend John Treadwell went into his pulpit with musket loaded, his sermon under one arm, and a cartridge box under another. I'm sure you'll find that in most churches across Edmond these days. When the news of Lexington and Bunker Hill arrived, parson after parson left his parish and marched hastily toward Boston. Before daylight on the morning of April the 30th, 1775, Stephen Farrar of New Ipswich, New Hampshire, had left with 97 of his parishioners. Joseph Willard of Beverly marched with two companies from his town, raised a no small part through his exertion. David Avery of Windsor, Vermont, after hearing the news of Lexington, preached a farewell sermon and then outside the meeting house door called his people to arms and marched with 20 men. On the way, he served as captain, preached, and collected more troops. David Grosvenor of Grafton left his pulpit, musket in hand, joined the Minutemen who marched to Cambridge. Philip Payson of Chelsea is given credit for leading a group of his parishioners to attack a band of English soldiers that 19th of April. Benjamin Balch of Danvers, lieutenant of the 3rd Alarm List in his town, was present at Lexington and later as chaplain in the Army and Navy, won the title of the Fighting Parson. Jonathan French of Andover, Massachusetts, left his pulpit on the Sabbath morning when the news of Bunker Hill arrived with a surgical case in one hand and a musket in the other and started for Boston. I guess he was going to shoot him and then try to fix him afterwards. One of the more famous was a man by the name of John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg. If you've been a member of my church, you've heard this story many times. But Muhlenberg heard about what was going on, and in his pulpit on January the 21st, 1776, he preached a message from Ecclesiastes chapter 3 with a text, "For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven." After he closed his message, he stepped down from his elevated pulpit and began to remove his black clerical robe, underneath it revealing the uniform of a colonial army officer. And he said this in the language of Holy Writ, "There is a time for all things. There is a time to pray and a time to fight. And that time has now come." And he threw off his robes and marched to the back of the church and enlisted 300 men from his own church and that community. And the next day they rode off to join General Washington. They formed the 8th Virginia Cavalry. He rose to the rank of Major General in the United States Army, served with Washington from Valley Forge through Yorktown. After the war, he served as a United States Congressman and a member of the Senate, and his statue stands in Statuary Hall as one of the 100 greatest Americans of all time. You can see him there taking off his black clerical robes, that statue in the United States Capitol. His brother, Frederick, who was a pastor in New York, wrote him a scathing letter condemning his behavior, to which Muhlenberg replied. He said, "You say as a clergyman, nothing can excuse my conduct. Well, I am a clergyman, it is true, but I am a member of society as well as the poorest layman, and my liberty is as dear to me as to any man. Shall I then sit still and enjoy myself at home when the best blood of the continent is spilling? Heaven forbid it." By the way, Frederick Muhlenberg had a change of heart when the British captured New York. There were 19 churches. The British burned 10 of them and desecrated 9 of them, turning them into bars, brothels, and stables. After Frederick Muhlenberg was thrown out of his church, he decided that pastors should be involved in civil issues. In fact, he wound up becoming the very first Speaker of the House of the very first House of Representatives under the United States Constitution. There's the Reverend James Caldwell, an ordained Presbyterian preacher, pastored in New Jersey. He was a chaplain and a soldier, most famous for during the Battle of Springfield, as his soldiers were running out of musket wadding. He kicked in the doors of the local Presbyterian church and came out with a stack of Sir Isaac Watts hymnals and began handing the hymnals out to his soldiers, imploring them to tear the pages out and use the pages for musket wadding. He said this expression. He said, "Put Watts in them, boys. Give them what for." And that's where that expression came from, originated with that battle. But about this, Headley says about Caldwell, said Mr. Caldwell was as earnest in the pulpit as he was out of it. He seldom preached without weeping himself and often would melt his audience to tears. He was a man of unwearied activity and of wonderful powers, both of body and mental endurance. Feelings of the most glowing piety and the most fervent patriotism occupied his bosom at the same time, without at all interfering with each other. He was one day preaching to the battalion, the next providing ways and means for their support, the next marching with them to battle, if defeated, assisting to conduct their retreat, if victorious, offering their united thanksgivings to God, and the next carrying the consolations of the gospel to some afflicted or dying parishioner. He and his family were both killed by the British before the war was over. Perhaps one of the most influential was a man named John Witherspoon. Witherspoon was a Presbyterian preacher who was the president of Princeton University. The British so hated him, they accused him of turning the campus into a seminary of sedition. But as the president of Princeton, he graduated 478 students who directly shaped America, including James Madison, who served as our president. Under his mentoring were 3 United States Supreme Court justices, 10 cabinet members, 13 state governors, 21 senators, 39 United States representatives, and 114 preachers. Through his students, there were 9 members of the Constitutional Convention, and Witherspoon himself served in the Continental Congress. And as we celebrate this week the 236th anniversary of the birth of our nation, recognize that it was this pastor who was one of the 56 who stared death in the face and pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to give us the liberty that we are now on the verge of losing. As those signers reflected on the grave consequences of signing this document that we call the Declaration of Independence, Witherspoon made this statement to those in the room: although these gray hairs must descend into the sepulcher, I would infinitely rather that they should descend thither by the hand of the executioner than desert at this crisis the sacred cause of my country. As you can see, ladies and gentlemen, Christians were not separate from American government. Christians drove it. The Bible was not contrary to American government. It was the cornerstone. And as you can see from biblical history and American history, pastors used to be men of courage that confronted evil instead of hiding behind their pulpits in fear. If it wasn't for the Great Awakening and these men called the Black Regiment, there would have been no Declaration of Independence, and there would have been no United States of America. On this week of our 236th birthday, may we, at least in this church, remember the foundation of our God-blessed land. And folks, will we be blessed or cursed in the future? It's up to us. God's promises, as here, are conditional. If we repent and turn back to Him, then our country can be saved. If we don't, then we are most certainly doomed. My commission to you, as those in this audience, and although we have had evangelism, as we talked about the new birth a while ago, but we've covered much this morning, my commission to you is one to pray. There's still power in prayer. Sometimes it may seem pointless, but it is not. 2 Chronicles 7:14 says, "If my people who are called by my name shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face, and if they will turn from their wicked ways, then," God says, "I will hear from heaven, and I will forgive your sin and heal your land." Second thing we must be doing is we must be diligent in evangelism. We're preaching a series right now on salvation. That's what we're interrupting that series right now for this 4th of July message. We'll be back on it next week. We've talked about how shall you escape if you neglect so great salvation. We've talked about what happens when saved people die. We've talked about what happens when lost people die. Next week we'll be talking about assurance of your salvation. Can you have doubts and be saved? You might want to be here for that one. After that, we'll be preaching about heaven, some other things. But the most important thing we can do, we've got Child Evangelism Fellowship, we've got Evangelism Explosion, we support missionaries, we send out missionaries, and hopefully all of you are equipped to be able to share your faith with others, at least be able to hand out a gospel tract and leave it on the table with a tip, if nothing else. But we have got to be concerned about seeing people come to Christ. I believe we're in the last days. I believe that the Lord could come today. So we need to be diligent about seeing people saved. My concern for the moral direction of America is that if the Lord tarries, where will we be in 10 years? And by the way, this pertaining to evangelism, are you saved? Remember all these stories we talked about? Those people that got saved, there was a change. Do you just call yourself a Christian, or is there evidence that you are? Number 3, we will confront sin. We will continue to confront sin. Ephesians 5 said that we are to have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. Then it goes on to say that we are to reprove the unfruitful works of darkness, which we will do and continue to do. And I don't know if you've noticed over the past year, it's amazing. There have been banners up and down some highways in Oklahoma City celebrating LGBT month. You know what? I have some preachers in Oklahoma City that don't do anything with Reclaiming America for Christ. They actually have the audacity to call me to tell me about it. I said, well, why don't you do something about it? Because you got to quit cowering behind your pulpit if you're going to actually get out and confront the culture. And number four, this church at least, and it's amazing what God can do, we are aware of the times. The Bible says in 1 Chronicles 12, dealing with after Saul's death, there was some discussion about whether one of his sons should assume the throne or whether David should go ahead and become king over all of Israel. He was already king over Judah. And it says that during this discussion that the children of Issachar, which were men that had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do, the heads of them, just about 200, and all their brethren at their commandment. These 200 that knew what was going on, that were politically savvy, were able to influence their whole tribe. And through that whole tribe, they were able to influence the 12 tribes. And they made the right decision. Got an opportunity for some great materials over here. Got some great materials on the Team B2 report that Michael Hain has. Brother Charlie has got a wealth of information covering much of what I talked about this morning. Folks, you need to know it. You need to be able to tell other people about it, share it with other people. One thing I discovered during this election cycle is we are the most uneducated people politically on the planet. We have the right to vote, and only about 15% actually went out and voted. Go knock on doors and talk about issues. People don't have the slightest clue about issues. You know, we had people that were voting for my opponent because they went to church with him. That's not a good excuse. We had people that were going to vote for me because I used to play football. I appreciate the support, but that is a terrible reason. We are politically and biblically illiterate. But we can do something about that because we know a lot. We've got a pretty well-educated group in here, and it's our responsibility to try to make a difference and reach out to others. God bless you. And may God bless America. We thank you for joining us for today's edition of Exploring the Word, and we look forward to being with you next time. Until then, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond. We hope that today's journey in God's Word has been a blessing to you. You can find more sermons and resources at our church's website, www.fairviewbaptistedmond.org, or call 405-348-1745. Join us again each weekday for Exploring the Word from Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond.